You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the night of August 13, 2004, Hutu militants crossed from Congo into Burundi and attacked the Gatumba Transit Center, in which 1,500 Banyamulenge Congolese Tutsi refugees had sought safe haven. 164 people were killed, 105 more were wounded, because pamphlets were distributed warning that the militants would come back. The survivors of the massacre were forced to flee, hiding in places where they were unable to seek adequate medical treatment or security. Now, 2 years later, nearly 600 of those Gatumba survivors have been resettled in the United States. With me now for an underreported segment is Sasha Chanoff, executive director of Mapendo International, one of the architects of the Gatumba settlement or resettlement, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. Hello.
For those of us who are not familiar with this particular conflict, can you tell us who are the Banyamulenge Tutsis and what political events led them to flee into Burundi?
Sure. Banyamulenge Tutsis are Congolese. They've lived in Congo for many centuries. And since 1996, there has been what is one of the worst conflicts in the world going on in Congo. Banyamulenge have been caught up in this in a number of ways, and civilians have been particularly targeted. So in May 2004, there were a number of Banyamulenge who fled across the border, fleeing ethnic violence to Burundi, were received in a camp, were afraid that they were too close to the border and could be attacked in a cross-border raid, and made this fear very clear. And then on August 13th, there was a cross-border raid, and they were attacked.
Now, I knew that Tutsis lived in Burundi, and of course they lived in Rwanda, but I guess I didn't know there was a large Tutsi population in Congo as well. Is this in any way connected to the ethnic conflict in Rwanda that claimed 800,000 lives?
Yeah, it certainly is. There are Congolese Tutsis who have lived there for many generations. These Banyamulenge have actually been there for a few centuries, and other Tutsis have been coming into Congo and settling in Congo since earlier last century and in 1959 and afterwards. In the Rwandan genocide in 1994, Hutu extremists were forced out of Rwanda and into Congo, and then started inciting the Congolese population against Tutsis. That led to the ongoing conflict in 1996, and this attack is kind of an extension of the conflict and the ethnic violence that's been going on.
So these Hutu militants may very well have come from Rwanda at the beginning of this whole story.
They initially started in Rwanda in 1994. They've been living in the forest, kind of the forest reaches of eastern Congo, for the past decade and more, and kind of inciting violence there.
We've just been joined by Olivier Mandevu, president of the Gatumba Refugee Survivors Foundation. I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show.
Thank you. What
happened that made you flee your home in Congo?
Yes, as Brother Sasha told you, it's because of wars and atrocities and oppressions which were being carried out against my community.
So you were living in a camp. What was
yes.
life in the camp like?
Yes, I was living in a camp before I came here.
And were the camps difficult to live in?
Yes, we came after the genocide which was committed against my people in the Gatumba camp. So when 166 people were killed and 116 were grievously wounded and traumatized, then after that horrible and inhuman genocide, then the government of the U.S. together with the U.N. agencies decided to relocate us here in the U.S.
Well, we'll get to that later, but I'm interested in what happened in the camps first. Had the Burundian government welcomed you? Were they administering these camps?
Yes. After when we fled from our country in June 2004 to Burundi, the Burundian government welcomed us and built a camp for us together with the UNHCR.
So where did you go after the massacre?
After the massacre, some of our people stayed in Burundi. Others went to Rwanda because they could feel more safe there than Burundi.
And what about you?
Myself, I went to Rwanda for some time, and then I came back to Burundi for me to be relocated in the U.S.
Sasha, so I'm assuming that Olivier's story is a typical one. People just went into Rwanda or other parts of Burundi in hopes of escaping this without any hope of going back home?
Yeah, just to back up for a moment, there are about 450,000 Congolese refugees who fled violence in Congo, and there are camps set up in Rwanda, in Uganda, and Burundi. And in fact, in 1997, there was a very similar massacre on a camp in Rwanda called the Mudende Massacre, where extremists crossed the border from Congo and massacred Tutsi refugees in Rwanda. The similar thing happened in Gatumba in 2004. These people don't have often a safe haven. These camps are set up to protect them, but often when camps are close to the border, they are attacked.
Well, these massacres are reported in the news, but then the stories quickly die down. How did you learn about the condition of the survivors?
Well, I had worked for the International Organization for Migration and the UNHCR, which is the UN Refugee Agency, for many years across Africa. And actually, in 1999 and 2000, the U.S. government initiated a rescue mission to evacuate Tutsi survivors of massacres in the Congo. And I was part of these rescue teams that flew into the Congo and extracted people who had survived these massacres. So I had been working with the U.S. government in refugee resettlement and extraction issues and got to know these Tutsis whom we evacuated in 1999-2000. About 1,500 of them at that time were resettled to the U.S.
But that was during the Clinton administration.
That was under the Clinton administration.
Did the U.S. policies continue under the Bush administration?
They did. In fact, we have a very generous refugee program. Our government has 70,000 resettlement slots that our president signs off on every single year. This has actually shrunk. Under the Reagan administration, there were many more slots, well over 100,000. Now it's about 70,000. But this is a humanitarian program to reach out to some of the most kind of vulnerable and at-risk refugees across the world. There are 19 resettlement countries around the world, and the U.S. brings in more refugees than all other countries combined.
You wrote a rescue resettlement proposal.
Yeah.
Was this your idea?
It was. I had seen across Africa that there were a lot of gaps in the humanitarian aid structure and world, and with a Kenyan doctor launched a new organization called Mapendo International. We were just founding our organization at this time when the Gatumba massacre took place. So I had been involved, again, in rescue resettlement missions before, and got in touch with some of the people that had resettled here a few years earlier, and they were very traumatized because they had lost relatives in this massacre. And after that, I called up the State Department and asked them if the U.S. government had any plans to try to evacuate or assist the survivors of this massacre. Word had gotten out that they were in hiding and they were in danger. They couldn't go home, they couldn't stay where they were, and they had no options left for them. And so I suggested that I go over to Burundi and put together a rescue resettlement proposal, and I got kind of the affirmative from the State Department, called up the UN. This was the first time that I was kind of acting independently with my own organization, and Burundi's not the safest place. The UN creates kind of security phases, ratings, security ratings for different conflict zones in different places around the world. In Burundi, the ratings range from 0, which is where we are right now, it's safe, to a 5, which means all UN staff evacuate. Burundi was between a 3 and a 4, which means that all UN staff need armed escorts. So I thought, I don't want to go there and get myself killed. I contacted the UN. They were my former employers, so I knew people there, and they arranged for me to visit the camp. So I went there and under a UN armed escort went out to the camp, met with some of the survivors who were living around the camp, went and found other survivors who were hiding in kind of hovels in some of the impoverished areas around the capital of Burundi, Bujumbura, and went to hospitals and visited people who were recovering from their injuries and put together this rescue resettlement proposal.
You had to convince people that they could trust you.
Yeah,
because they were in hiding, many of them.
Mm-hmm. I had kind of had an introduction because I knew this community very well from this previous rescue mission in 99 and 2000. And I'd been working in U.S. Resettlement issues for a long time. So I had introductions to people from those who are here.
My guests are Sasha Chanoff, Executive Director of Mapendo International, and Olivier Mondevu, president of the Gatumba Refugee Survivors Foundation. So had any of the Tutsis tried to go home to Congo?
Some had, actually. After this massacre, people were so overwhelmed and horrified and felt that there were no safe havens for them anywhere. Some decided, if we're going to be killed, we might as well be killed in our homes. And some tried to return to Congo. Congo has the largest peacekeeping force in the world right now. There are 17,000 UN peacekeepers on the ground in Congo. When these people returned to try to go back home, they were attacked and stoned by villagers in their homes, and they had to be surrounded by the peacekeepers and protected. So it was very clear that they could not go home.
Well, once you locate people, it's one thing to locate them. It's another thing to then get them all together and be able to take them out of these situations. You got approval. Where did the money come from?
Well, so what I did was I went to the State Department and to the UN Refugee Agency and presented this rescue resettlement proposal and highlighted the fact that these people can't go home and they can't stay where they are and they're in danger and they're traumatized. And in fact, this group represented kind of the high watermark of at-risk refugees in Africa. And finally, the State Department and UN agreed that this was the right course of action. And then the UN actually put a team together and sent this team into Bujumbura and started interviewing the survivors of the massacre.
Olivier, where were you living at this time?
Yes, after the genocide, because we call it the genocide, but the other people don't call it a genocide, but for us it's a genocide. And
well, this is part of a larger genocide
yes.
that we saw in Rwanda, and to
yes.
some degree, for a little while, there were similar things happening in Burundi, weren't there?
In Burundi since 1993 and in Congo, there has been widespread conflict.
Yes.
And it's mostly killing Tutsis or moderate Hutus.
No, it's killings of Tutsi, and it's a continuation of the Rwandan genocide. And after that, as you asked me, I left there to Rwanda because we could feel somehow safe in Rwanda. Than in Burundi.
And why wouldn't you have just stayed there? Would it have been possible for you to establish a life in Rwanda?
So it was very hard since that time I lost my mother, my brother. So staying with my brothers and the little kids of my brother. So it was very hard for us to live there in Rwanda, even though we were safe. But finding food and other facilities for us to live, it was very hard. So since we got the opportunity of being supported by the government of the U.S., so we need to return to Burundi for us to come here in the U.S.
Well, how were you contacted? How did you connect with the U.N. rescue team?
Yes, the U.N. rescue team, when they arrived in Bujumbura, they spoke with the survivors. They told them, please inform the other survivors wherever they are in Rwanda. Tell them to come because we need to support them, to help them to go to the U.S. So our fellow survivors, they gave us telephone calls when we were in Rwanda to come, and then we came to Burundi.
And I'm sure not everybody was approved. Sasha, how what kind of process is involved, and what would keep a refugee from gaining access to the United States?
Well, the U.S. refugee program, there's actually a number of quite complicated steps that have to go on before people can actually be resettled here. I was working with the U.N. team to help put that team together, and resettlement is complicated. There are over 3 million refugees in Africa. Only about 1% or less than 1% of these people will actually be resettled to a country where they can rebuild their lives. So a lot of people often want access to that. So we actually planned out for a long time to ensure that we would find the right people, the people who actually survived this massacre. They had been registered in Gatumba, but what we really had was a name and a registration ID. So there was the process included. A UN team went on the ground, interviewed thousands of people, not in a resettlement context, but asking them who they were, where they had been, and those that said that they had been at Gatumba were then kind of blocked off for additional interviews. Those interviews took place, and then those cases or each story of each person was forwarded to the U.S. government. Then the U.S. government sends in the Department of Homeland Security officials to actually conduct additional interviews, and then those Department of Homeland Security officers either approve or deny a case. if a case is approved, there are a series of security checks, background checks, and medical exams before people arrive here.
This is a long process. It took a couple of years, didn't it?
It did take a couple of years. Part of that was because there was a lot of bureaucracy and there was not a team in place on the ground quickly enough.
How much does politics play a role in all of this? I've heard that in the case of Darfur, pretty much all of the refugees are going to Sweden or some other countries in Europe, but none are coming to the United States. Do we pick and choose the victims?
That's a very good question. During the Cold War, the U.S. government formalized a refugee program in the 80s, and during the Cold War, it was very politically oriented to refugees in communist countries who are fleeing communist countries. Now, I would argue that a large part of the program is humanitarian. It's based on humanitarian grounds. Darfurians have not started arriving in the U.S. en masse because the processing system has not started yet, but we are resettling refugees from Liberia, Sierra Leone, from Sudan, Congo, Ethiopia, Somalia, and countries around the world.
Olivia, where have you been resettled?
I've been resettled in Albany, New York.
In Albany?
Albany, New York.
Is that a good fit?
Yes, it's a good fit.
Not a culture shock? What about some of the other people? Well, you speak English very well, but I suspect not everybody who was resettled speaks English.
Yes, the majority of our people don't speak English. They speak French because our country is a French-speaking country. And in terms of culture, I think they are copying. They are copying, and the majority of them, almost all of them, are learning English, and some of them can speak at least a little English.
Is Albany one of the areas that most of the resettlement is taking place in?
No. People have been resettled in almost all states of the United States of America. So Albany is one of the places where the survivors have been resettled.
Are people talking about wanting to return home once the situation back there improves?
Yes, they are very nostalgic about their motherland, and their wish, their prayer that things get better for them to turn back to their country someday.
Well, we've seen documentaries about the Lost Boys, Sudan, and the problems that they've had in adjusting to the conditions here. On the other hand, it doesn't look like they'll wind up going back. Eventually, people do become assimilated. Is that what you think will probably happen in these cases, Sasha?
They certainly do. I would say, first of all, that all refugees would love to go home. They'd like nothing more than to return to their homelands. That's often not an option. A really interesting phenomenon with the Sudanese Lost Boys is that many of them are now starting up organizations to help rebuild their homes. Dave Eggers recently wrote a book called What is the What?
He was here with the author of the book.
Check, right. And that book is gaining a lot of attention. There is the most recent documentary is a film called God Grew Tired of Us. Both Valentino and the star of God Grew Tired of Us, John Dow, have started up organizations, have raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, and are helping to rebuild. I've seen in my 15 years of refugee resettlement here in the U.S., that people come here, they take advantage of what's available here. There's a Sudanese girl that I met in Kakuma camp in northern Kenya about 6 years ago. She was emaciated and 17 years old and orphaned. She just finished Brandeis on an accelerated 3-year program on full scholarship and is planning to go to law school. These people all want to go back and rebuild, so people have the opportunities here and then take those, and then when things do become safe, often they look to their home lens again.
Olivier, what does your organization, the Gatumba Refugee Survivors Foundation, do? Is this just a way for people to connect once they've come to the United States?
Yes, one of the goals of this organization is for the survivors to have some kind of network connection to one another. And goal number two is to work for the memorial or the memory of the deceased. And number three is to work and rally the international community for justice. You see, since the genocide has been committed, nothing has been done to establish justice, to bring the the perpetrators into trial. So our mission is to work for that. Number four is to work for healing and regeneration, working with organizations, working with churches in order to help our people to get healing and regeneration, because the majority of them have been traumatized, greatly traumatized. And number five is to work together with other communities from our country and from our region in order to try to build a community where there is love, unity, and reconciliation.
What about some of those goals, Sasha? Is it likely that these Hutu militants will ever be captured, brought to trial?
They've been active in Eastern Congo for the past decade since the Rwandan genocide. This is actually one of the kind of thorns in the side of the peacekeepers and the ongoing peace efforts in Congo. In Eastern Congo in 2005, the UN said this is the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. So it's still going on. So not necessarily some people, but certainly there are possibilities for peace. I think a lot of people sometimes misunderstand violence as deeply entrenched ethnic hatreds. It's often not the case. What is the case is that there are political motivations and power motivations that play ethnic tensions off against each other.
And as we saw in Rwanda, a lot of it was a legacy of the years
rule.
Of Belgian colonial
mm-hmm,
rule.
Mm-hmm.
We have Olivier in Albany. What are some of the other places that refugees have been sent to?
Yes, the other set of refugees have been sent. We have one family in Seattle, Washington, many families in Texas, Houston, and Tucson, many families in Arizona, in Phoenix, and many families in one family in New Mexico, Wisconsin, Chicago, Virginia, North Carolina, Maine, and Ohio. And in Missouri, in almost a lot of states of the United States.
Sasha, is that the best way to do it? I would think that it would be better to try to keep people together in communities because they share cultural needs, they culinary needs, they have language difficulties.
Maybe we should bring you on to help advise the U.S. government refugee
program. They put in one family in New Mexico.
How the U.S. Refugee program works is if families do not have relatives here, they are allocated to a certain city. There are 10 resettlement agencies active across the U.S. that are funded by the government, and those resettlement agencies have affiliates in most cities, and so people are allocated to different cities. Often it's done also according to where needs might fit. If there's a widow with a lot of children, she might go to a particular place that has services with widows. One of the cases that I'm keeping track of is a young girl named Aline. I think you have a picture of her right in front of you there. She was at the massacre. Her parents were killed. She was shot through the back and burned very badly by the extremists who came in. She was found the next morning alive. She was 9 years old. She lost her parents. Her four-year-old cousin who's with her in that picture also lost parents. And she and her four-year-old cousin and four-year-old brother resettled with their grandmother to Denver. She's undergoing surgery very soon for the gunshot wound in her leg.
There are 70,000 annual resettlement slots. Are all of them filled?
No. In fact, this is one of the reasons we founded Mapendo International. Last year, 30,000 slots went unfilled, even though there are well over 9 million refugees worldwide. Many of these people cannot return home and cannot integrate where they are locally. A lot of slots go unfilled, and there are a variety of reasons for that, but one of them is there are inadequate mechanisms to identify the people at the most risk. That's what I saw when I worked on the ground across Africa, and that's kind of the drive behind founding Mapendo International. To reach out to forgotten people.
Just one more thing, since there is a very strong anti-immigrant sentiment throughout parts of this country, does that exacerbate this problem?
I haven't seen that the anti-immigrant sentiment exacerbates this problem. Last year, 30,000 or close to 40,000 refugees resettled to the U.S. What we see with refugees is they often have this tremendous drive to work. They often take jobs that nobody else wants to take. They go to school. And we have a large population in the U.S. that reaches out to refugees. We saw this, I think, in particular with the Sudanese Lost Boys. But I think when you put a face on what people have gone through, when you look at Aline there, you feel this is something that I want to get involved with. And I think when you had Valentino Achak on the show, he's a great example of somebody who has inspired Americans. And these refugees become citizens in 5 years. That's part of our program.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Sasha Chanoff, Executive Director of Mapendo International, and Olivier Mandevu, President of the Gatumba Refugee Survivors Foundation. And Olivier, I hope that there is a time you can return home if you want.
Thanks so much.